Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Metropolitan Community College on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a talk by Baba Jallo, Assistant Professor of African History and Director of the African Studies Program at Creighton University. He'll speak on the topic, The Great Kings and Queens of Africa. Until the middle of the 20th century, some Western scholars continued to deny that Africa has a history. The historical evidence suggests otherwise. Many centuries before Europeans came to Africa, great kingdoms, empires, and civilizations existed across the continent. They were ruled by great kings and queens, some of whom confronted and valiantly resisted European colonial domination. Some of their stories will be examined in this presentation. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, February 6, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Metropolitan Community College, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Barbara Velasquez, Coordinator of International and Intercultural Education at Metropolitan Community College.
I called Dr. Jallo some time ago to ask him about doing a presentation on kings and queens of Africa, and I'm delighted to say that he immediately agreed to come to our campus and said, I will only add one thing to that, great kings and queens of Africa, which I believe is a great impression of what he will offer to us today. Dr. Baba G. Jallo is Assistant Professor of African History and Director of the African Studies Program at Creighton University. He holds a BA in History and Political Science from Farah Bay College, the University of Sierra Leone, an MA in Liberal Studies from Rutgers University in New Jersey, and a PhD in History from the University of California, Davis. His research interests include the history of colonial and post-colonial Africa, censorship in Africa, Islam in Northwest Africa, and Catholics and social justice in Africa. Jallo is the current editor of the Journal of Critical Southern Studies. Please welcome Dr. Baba G. Jallo, PhD, Assistant Professor, Department of History, Director of African Studies, Creighton University, as he presents The Great Kings and Queens of Africa.
Thank you, Barbara, for that kind introduction, and thank you to Metropolitan Community College for inviting me to be part of Black History Month. I am part of Black History, and so I'm happy to be part of Black History Month celebrations. I also thank the audience for kindly taking time to come and listen to me. I hope that the presentation meets your expectations, at least, if not exceed them. So any study of Africa, whether it's the study of women and gender, whether it's the study of apartheid, whether it's the study of colonialism, needs to start from a basic background that would give the audience a sense of what Africa is and how Africa has evolved as a historical object over time. There are 55 countries in Africa. There were 54 countries until 2012 when Southern Sudan, right there, gained independence from Northern Sudan, and so we now have 55 countries in Africa. Now, a lot of people in the United States, I know from my experience teaching African history, that people tend to believe that Africa is one country. There are some people who believe that Africa is actually a continent and not a country. And so you have the entire United States, the entire China, India, Eastern Europe, parts of Western Europe, all put into Africa and still with some small spaces. Now, I also like to bring about knowledge about how Africa was conceived in the Western imagination until very recently, and even to some extent, even today. So the picture you're seeing here is a representation of what Africa was thought to be by Herodotus, the father of Africa, or father of history. Now, Herodotus believed that if you went to Africa, you will see people with faces on their chests, people with one large leg, or people with their eye in the middle of their foreheads. So what is happening here is that Herodotus is superimposing characters and creatures from Greek mythology onto Africa. And as a result of that, you had people thinking of Africa as the dark continent. I also like to indicate that Africans were considered cannibals until very recently. And here you have a mom telling her child not to play with his food. So Africans were considered cannibals as well, in addition to being considered almost cyclops. Now here you have a map of the great chain of being. And in this picture on the right here, you have a comparison of a Caucasian man and an African man. And the idea is that the African man resembles more the monkey than a human being. So these are all stereotypes that existed in the minds of Western Europeans. And to some extent, they still do exist in some parts of the West. Now, there is also what we know as the Hamitic hypothesis. The Hamitic hypothesis believes or argues that great civilizations that were found by European explorers in Africa were not built by Africans because they were too marvelous. The pyramids of Egypt, the ruins of Aksum, Great Zimbabwe, and a lot of other civilizations were believed to have been built by white people from the East and not Africans because they were just too elaborate to be built by Africans. The Hamitic hypothesis also suggests that Africans are the cursed children of Noah's son, Ham. Now, we know the biblical story about Ham coming in unto his father when he's naked, and then his father says, "You are cursed, and you shall be the slave of your brethren." And as a result of that, Africa was considered a dark continent in need of the light of Western civilization, and that Africans needed a civilizing mission that was to be conducted through the process of colonization as well as the bringing of Christianity to Africa. So these are just background information that is necessary to get into how we came to the history of Africa and the history of the great kings and queens that we are going to discuss. Now, there is also, finally, the myth of tribal Africa. Europeans believed that Africans were consisting of a number of distinct tribes that were separate, they were isolated, they spoke their own languages, they had their own different cultures, and that they were always at war with each other, that always fighting each other. Now, this, of course, is not a valid myth, because tribes or ethnic groups, as we like to call them, were not bounded categories. They, you know, merged together, they intermarried, and they considered themselves more as farmers or other professionals as opposed to as their own tribal identities. Even though tribes did exist in Africa, they were not isolated as people thought they were. Now, coming on to the latter stages of this phase of the background, people like George Hegel actually argued that Africans had no history, that Africa, in Africa, history is out of the question. Man has not progressed beyond a merely sensuous existence and has found it impossible to develop any further. All our observations of African man show him living in a state of savagery and barbarism, and he remains in this state to this day. Now, this was written in the late 18th to early 19th centuries, but you will be surprised to find that in the latter part of the 20th century, this idea of Africa not being a suitable subject of history or not having history was still existing. Now, Hugh Trevor Roper was a British scholar, and this as late as 1963, he was able to say that in the future, perhaps, there will be some African history. But at present, there is none, that there is only the history of Europeans in Africa. The rest is darkness, and darkness is not a subject of history. And Hugh Trevor Roper went on to say that historians could not afford to amuse themselves with the unrewarding gyrations of barbarous tribes in picturesque but irrelevant corners of the globe. In other words, Africa was irrelevant, you know, to the world, and the historians could not manage to afford to study this dark continent. Now, the interesting thing about this guy is that he was speaking as late as 1963. By 1963, almost 95% or 98% of African countries had gone through 400 years of slavery, had gone through about a century of colonization and had attained independence. And so by 1963, for someone to come out and say that Africans had no history was just, you know, mind-boggling to a lot of scholars who studied African history. Now, let's go on to the evidence to show that, in fact, before the Europeans came to Africa, great kingdoms existed and great empires existed in Africa. These are some of the kingdoms and empires that existed in Africa before the colonial encounter. And we are looking at this map because we need to kind of dispel the myth of Africa without history. And so some of the kings and queens that we are going to look at were kings and queens of empires and kingdoms, just like the ones we have in the map here. Now, the first set of rulers or kings, great kings that we look at, come from the Empire of Mali that existed in the 14th century, in the 1300s. Now, the Empire of Ghana existed earlier than that, but there is very little material that we can use in terms of the biographies of rulers or the histories of actual kings and queens. And so the most we had is from 13th century. Now, the griot is shown here because the griot is the traditional historian of Africa. They are families that exist in Africa to this day, and they are musicians, and they are philosophers, and they are peacemakers. But above all, they collect and preserve the histories of their communities, and they collect and preserve the histories of kings and battles and a lot of other events that happened in pre-colonial Africa. Now, thanks to the griot, we were able to learn about the life histories of great kings and queens of Mali, such as Sundiata Keita, who existed in the first half of the 13th century. Sundiata Keita was the founder of the great empire of Mali that we have here. You can see that it was a vast territory from the west coast of Africa towards the middle central Africa here down to the southeast Africa. So Sundiata was the emperor or the founder of Mali, and the Mali empire was the home of the Malinke people. They are still in present-day Mali, or the Mande-speaking people. Now, the Malinke were a large ethnic group. They were a large ethnic group with many established chiefdoms, small chiefdoms in the western part of Africa. At one point, they were unified into one group by their conquest by Sumauru, king of Susu. Sumauru was a very tyrannical king. And so his tyranny led the Malians into searching for a leader to lead them against this tyrannical king and to unify them and expand their power. And so they found this king in the person of Sundiata Keita. Now, Sundiata had a very strange childhood. He was born a cripple. He couldn't walk until the age of around 9-10. And then when he was able to walk, a few years later, he was exiled by his stepmother, the older wife of the king of Mali, one of the kingdoms of Mali at the time. So when the Malinke decided to unite and look for a leader, they found this leader in Sundiata. Sundiata ruled led them against Sumauru, and he defeated Sumauru at what is known as the Battle of Kirina in 1235. So he conquered the Susu, he drove them out of Mali, and he unified the kingdom of Mali and built upon it. So that by the time of Sundiata's death, Mali was a great and flourishing empire in the Western Sudan. And this is Mansa Musa. Mansa Musa was one of the descendants, one of the successors to Sundiata Keita. He was not part of Sundiata's family. Rather, he was a general in the army of Sundiata Keita, and he was emperor of Mali from 1312 to 1337. Now, Mansa Musa is literally known as the richest man ever in history. A recent study by Forbes showed that Mansa Musa is still considered the richest man in history. So Mansa Musa came into power and ended the leadership struggles that plagued Mali after the death of Sunjata. He strengthened the military, he imposed peace and law and order, and he expanded the boundaries of the Mali Empire by appointing famous generals. So before he came to power, the practice was conquered states were ruled by their own chiefs and kings. But he changed that because the chiefs and kings were rebelling a lot, and so he now appointed famous generals as the rulers of the regions. He also instituted national honors, national awards, like the Congressional Medal of Honor, you know, national awards. His Medal of Honor was called the National Honor of the Trousers. And he had these trousers, these very, very large robes that were given to people who had rendered great service to the empire. And it was a great pride for people to have these great robes. He was very strict against governors that kind of inflicted injustice on his people. He established friendly relations with foreign states such as Morocco and Egypt. So he actually had relations with kingdoms like Morocco and Egypt. And he encouraged Islamic learning and invited Muslim scholars from North Africa and the Middle East to come to Mali so that they would help in the running of his empire. Now, Mansa Musa is best known in African history for his pilgrimage to Mecca in 1324 and 1325. And during this pilgrimage, he went with thousands of slaves and thousands of soldiers, each carrying a staff of gold weighing 4 pounds, and thousands of soldiers and officials and dignitaries. So it was a huge retinue that traveled across the desert to Mecca so that the emperor would perform the pilgrimage. And during this travel, he gave away so much gold in Cairo that the price of gold fell in the region for the next 10 years. For the next decade, he just, you know, gave up so much gold that the price of gold fell in Cairo and the area for the next 10 years. And as a result of that pilgrimage, Mali appeared on a European map for the first time. So he actually helped advertise Mali to the external world. And that had some good and some bad consequences. The good consequences was that Africa became known to the Western world, and they stopped saying that Africa didn't have a history. The bad thing, among other things, was that it attracted predators in the form of explorers and people who wanted a share of this vast gold. Mansa Musa died in 1337. So the next great kings that we're going to look at were rulers of the Empire of Songhai. After Mansa Musa's death, there were lots of power struggles, and eventually the Empire of Mali, after a long time, actually declined, and in its place rose the Empire of Songhai. The Empire of Songhai was also in that region of West Africa, but further south, and it grew larger than the Empire of Mali. Now, Sony Ali is the other great emperor that we are going to look at, because Sony Ali was the founder of the Songhai Empire. Not a lot is known about him, but enough is known about him to enable us to talk about him. So by the time Sony Ali came to power in Songhai, the Songhai people were conquered by the Musi. The Musi were a very warlike tribe who lived in the forest region of Africa. And so after he conquered the Musi, he expanded the boundaries of the Songhai Empire. And for the first time in the history of West African kingdoms, he established a navy because they lived along the banks of the Niger River. And so a segment of his military were actually a navy that, you know, went on its campaigns with ships. Now, Sony Ali is described in some chronicles as a very tyrannical ruler who was cruel, who was unjust, and who persecuted Muslims and the Fulani. But in other chronicles, he is described as a great and nice person. Now, we don't know what to believe in terms of these conflicting reports on the same man. So all we can say is that he was a great ruler, and he was able to unify the Songhai, and he was able to rule according to the tenets of traditional Songhai religion. He was not a Muslim. So he was very hostile to the Muslims and the Fulani. He was hostile to the Muslims because he thought that they were out to sabotage his work, and he was hostile for the same reason to the Fulani. Now, the Fulani are herdsmen. They move from one region to the other in search of grazing land. Now, Mansa Musa was trying to stabilize his empire, and there was this group of people who would never stay in one place, and so he grew very, very hostile to them. Now, by the time of his death in 1492, the Songhai Empire had become had been built upon solid foundations for his successor, another great king of Africa known as Askia Muhammad, who ruled the Songhai, who lived from 1443 to 1538. Now, Askia Muhammad was not related to Sunni Ali. He was one of his generals. He was his army commander. And after Sunni Ali died, he actually overthrew Sunni Ali's son and took power and then expanded the kingdom of Songhai, the empire of Songhai, and made it very, very powerful. He also made a pilgrimage to Mecca, and while he was there, he was appointed Khalif of the Sudan, Khalif of the black people. Now, imagine an Arab cleric back in Saudi Arabia pretending to appoint the Khalif of the blacks in Sunni Ali, in Askia Muhammad. In any case, Askia Muhammad was the Khalif of the blacks, and he ruled for a long time and also established diplomatic relations with Muslim leaders in the Middle East and North Africa. Now, my favorite part, we still have a couple of guys, but we should change into women. Queen Zinga of Angola was one of the greatest queens in African history around the 16th and the 17th century. Now, Queen Zinga was not a queen initially. She was the brother of a man who took over power from his father just at the time that the Portuguese were trying to conquer Southern Africa. And so present-day Angola is situated in the area where we had the Kingdom of the Ndongo. The Kingdom of Angola actually was a creation, was a name that was invented by the Portuguese. Before Angola, the area was known as the Ndongo, the Kingdom of Ndongo. And so Queen Zinga was the daughter of one of the kings of the Zongo. He was called Kilwanji. He was a late 16th century king. And when he died, he was succeeded by his eldest son, Mbandi. But Mbandi proved to be a weakling, and so he was cowed by the Portuguese, and he turned to his sister for help. It was Queen Zinga who actually stepped in and resisted the Portuguese for a very, very long time. And this is a famous picture of Queen Zinga when he was meeting the Portuguese governor. Now, at the time, if an African ruler came to meet the Portuguese, the Europeans, they were expected to sit on the floor, whereas the Portuguese would sit on a seat here. Now, when Queen Zinga came in and there was no seat, one of her bodyguards, who was also a female, actually came down and knelt so Queen Zinga would avoid sitting on the ground to maintain her dignity. And that's the picture that we see there. Here we have her as a warrior, and here wearing the queen, the crown. She resisted the Portuguese successfully. Eventually, they were forced into the negotiating table, and they were forced to sign a treaty of peace and to return her sister, who had been captured, in return for the freedom of certain Portuguese soldiers who were also captured by Zinga. She died on December 17, 1663, at the age of 82. Now, we go back to one other guy. I'm conscious of the time here, so we'll try to cover as much as we can. Now, Samori Toure is known in African history as the nemesis of the French in West Africa. Now, one of the ways in which Europeans subjugated and colonized African peoples was to sign treaties of friendship with the chiefs. Now, these treaties of friendship were required by the Berlin Act that was created at the Berlin Conference of 1884-85. So if a European country laid claim to an area, they had to show evidence of subjugation, of control, of ownership. And so for this reason, the Europeans normally signed treaties of friendship, but the treaties of friendship actually meant that, you know, actually declared that I, King Baba of MCC, hereby declare that I hand over my country to the Europeans. Now, Samori signed such a treaty, and then shortly afterwards, he realized that this was actually a treaty saying that he had given up his empire, the Mandinka Empire of West Africa. And so when he saw this, he repudiated the treaty, he sent it back to the French, and he declared war on them. And he fought the French for the longest time in the history of West Africa. He fought them for 8 long years, from like 1891 to 1898. You know, for 8 years, Samori resisted the French. This is a statue of him in present-day Guinea, in Conakry. His kingdom was around the Guinea area, and he conducted a lot of military strategies that were surprising to the French, because they did not know that an African ruler could be so clever. Now, finally, let's look at Ya Asantewaa, another great queen of Africa. Ya Asantewaa is known as the nemesis of the British. She was a queen mother of the kingdom of empire of Asante that actually resisted the British for over 100 years. For over 100 years, the British could not bring Asante in present-day Ghana, who was known as the Gold Coast, into the fold of the British Empire. Now, towards the end of that long period of resistance, there was this lady, Ya Asantewaa. You can see her here in her older age carrying a gun, and she's also carrying a gun right here. So Ya Asantewaa came into the picture, actually took over power when the king of Asante, Premfe I, and her own son, who was the king of a lesser Asante kingdom, were captured and exiled by the British. And so the Asante chiefs and the lesser kings were afraid to face up the British. And so Ya Asantewaa stepped forward and took over and said to the men that if you guys are afraid to face the British, then we, the women, would come forward and face the British. And she actually did just that. And the event that led to the outbreak of the last resistance of the Asante against the British happened in 1900, when the British governor of the Gold Coast, Sir Frederick Hutchin, actually visited Kumasi, the capital of Asante, and demanded that the Asante bring out their sacred golden stool. You know, bring out the golden stool. I want to sit on it. And they were like, you are crazy. No one has ever sat on the golden stool, and no one will ever sit on the golden stool. So the people just dispersed, including Ya Asantewaa, and at night they held a meeting, and the next day they launched a rebellion against the British. They surrounded the British fort in Kumasi, and it lasted for about 3 months. They laid siege to the fort for 3 months, and eventually the British actually had to sneak out of the fort and run away. But eventually the British governor called for reinforcements, and about 2,500 soldiers were sent from England, and they attacked Asante and eventually captured Ya Asantewaa and exiled her to the Seychelles Islands, where she lived for the next 20 years before her death in 1921. So I think that would be a brief summary of the talk on great kings and queens of Africa. There are lots of other kings and queens, but for time constraints, we can't naturally go into all of those. Well, I thank you very much for your attention, and I would be happy to take questions.
What year was that? I'm sorry, what year was it that the British finally captured Ya Asantewaa?
Ya Asantewaa was captured in 1900. 1900, yes. The resistance lasted for several months, about 6 to 7 months, but eventually they were able to capture her, and then they exiled her to the Seychelles Islands, and she spent the next 20 years there and died there in 1921.
This is a tremendous amount of good information. And
thank you.
Are there some resources that, you know, I was writing pretty fast,
yes,
and I was missing part of it. Can you give us some resources that we might go to that wouldn't be huge?
In terms of doing research for this, do you work at a university?
Pardon?
Do you work at a university?
No?
Well, there are lots of books, like a history of West Africa, for instance. If you search on Amazon.com, you will get, you know, a history, type in a history of West Africa or a history of Africa, and you will get lots of good books on that. If you were working at a university, then I could ask you to go to JSTOR and just do a search.
Thank you. Now, next question.
Yes.
Where were these kings and queens at the time the slaves were brought to the United States? Is that a different area of Africa from where the slaves came, or what?
No, not necessarily. The slaves came from different parts of Africa, Africa, from Central Africa, from South Africa, and from East Africa. And these kings lived in different eras of African history. Now, all the kings that we looked at here, with the exception of the first three, lived after, you know, during the period of the slave trade and after, but they were not affected by the slave trade. The slave trade mostly affected the coastal populations, the coastal kingdoms.
So these were more interior part of Africa?
Yes, with the exception of Yasantewa in Ghana and Queen Zinga, they also lived along the coast. But one important thing is that some of the kings that lived during the slave trade actually participated in the slave trade. They actually, the slave trade was good business, so if you could capture lots of slaves and sell them, you could sell them for guns, and then you would strengthen your army, and you could conquer other people. So they are great, but, you know, they also had their ifs and buts.
I actually have a question.
Yes.
And it may be related to what you just said. The king who you said was known as the richest man in history?
Mansa Musa.
Can you tell us how he made his money?
In
general.
That's very interesting. Most of those kingdoms, the kingdom of Ghana, the kingdom of Mali, and the kingdom of Songhai, relied on two sources of revenue, or actually three. One was the trans-Saharan trade, the trade between the Central and Western Africa and North Africa that existed from around 500 AD onwards. Now, the Trans-Saharan trade, by controlling the Trans-Saharan trade, they could charge import and export duties, and they got lots of revenue from that. Now, the next source of revenue was the tribute that was paid by conquered states. The empire would conquer states, and they would have to pay tributes to the central authority. But the biggest source of revenue was the gold mines. There was just lots of gold mines, and, you know, this gold was mined, and it was traded, and the king had lots of control over it. So that's how he got all that gold, because he controlled the gold-producing regions of Bore and Bambouk and other places that fell within the boundaries of his empire.
Yeah, I have a question. Mm-hmm. So this Queen Nzinga of Angola, was she a princess? Was she a daughter of the king?
Yes, she was.
Who was her father?
Her father's name is, excuse me to check out the name. It's not easy to remember these names. She was Kiluwangi.
Kiwangi?
Kiluwangi.
Kiluwangi.
Kiluwangi was her father, but she was not next in line to succession. Her elder brother was.
Bambori?
Huh?
Bambari?
Mbandi.
Mbandi?
Yes. Mbandi was her elder brother, and he succeeded to the throne after his father's death. But Mbandi appeared to be, you know, proved to be weak. He was not strong enough for the Portuguese. And
he wasn't strong enough to be king?
No, he was strong enough to be king. He wasn't strong enough to resist the Portuguese. And so he had to call.
So the was passed down to Zynga.
Yeah, he called Zynga to help. Well, I guess so. One interesting fact about Queen Zynga, I almost passed, and it's very interesting, is that Queen Zynga had a harem of young men who dressed like women, and they were her wives. Yeah, about 30 of them at any point in time were her wives. But then when she retired at the age of 75 or 76, she let go of the harem, and then she married one of her wives who became her husband or her wife, whichever you put it. Well, that's an interesting fact about Queen Zynga. He owned a harem of men, so she was a very strong lady.
I think I was like her in my past life. But no. Anyway, can you explain the concept of Queen Mother to those who are in attendance?
Yes, the Queen Mother in many countries, especially in among the Asante,
and their responsibility.
Yes, she was the mother of the king. The Queen Mother was the mother of the king, and she was responsible for advising the king. She was responsible for talking to people who wanted to see the king. Essentially, she served an advisory role. And just in case the king had an illness, or there was no clear succession, or he died, or he went into battle, the Queen Mother would step in to play the role of a regent until the king returned. But essentially, her role was advisory. But she was a very, very powerful figure. Now, in the case of Ya Asantewa, the king and her own son, who was also a king, were actually exiled, and the men, the chiefs of Asante and the kings of Asante, proved not strong enough or brave enough to face up to the British, and so she stepped up and took over the leadership role in that situation.
Wow, interesting.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit like what daily life might have been like in Mansa Musa Smali, what marriage customs were, how families interacted, how kids were raised.
That's more a job of an anthropologist, but I do have an idea because most of those customs haven't changed a lot in a lot of rural Africa, and they are very similar across the Western Africa. And the Mande people across West Africa. So there are some Mande people in Gambia. Essentially, in terms of marriage, for instance, there were different kinds of marriages. There were arranged marriages. In some instances, a young man and a young woman, or a young man would see a young woman and want to marry her, and then they would send his parents. So the young man did not go and say to a girl, "I want to marry you," or "Will you marry me?" They actually sent parents, and then once their interest was registered, they could be asked to bring kola nuts. Kola nuts are a very, very common fruit. Is it a fruit? It's kind of a fruit, kola nuts. So you bring the kola nuts and say, "I want my son to marry your daughter." And then, you know, the negotiation kind of continues, and if the two, the couples like each other, then they would name a bride price, and the bride price would be paid, and then there is an elaborate set of rituals and ceremonies that are performed until the wedding night. In terms of raising children, children were just raised like they are raised in Africa today. They are born into families, and they grow up, they learn the customs of the family, they take on the religions of the family, they know that, you know, they have an extended family, aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters. So the family unit in Africa is an extended family system. Now, the other way that marriages were arranged, and there were lots of marriages, marriage arrangements, was that once a woman is pregnant, depending on her situation and depending on the context, she could say, "If my child is a girl, I will give her to your son, or I'll give her to you in marriage." And so if the baby is born and it's a girl, they tie a small piece of cloth around her wrist saying, "We are keeping you for so and so, such and such a man." Now, that is happening still in some parts of Africa. It doesn't matter whether the girl grows up and likes the man or dislikes the man. In many instances, once that knot was tied, it was tied for good. But nowadays, you know, recently, we know that a lot of girls have been rebelling against this tradition. In Kenya, a lot of girls are running away to live with relatives or to live with missionaries and nuns in the church. But, you know, there is a large set of rituals that were associated with child marriage and child rearing among the Malinke and in other parts of Africa. Yeah?
I'm curious about the sources of information for, like, when we go back to the Mansa Musa.
Yeah.
I mean, the griots, of course, but what, is there a written history, or who was the source of the, I mean, how was this information documented for us today?
Oh, yeah. For today, today we have a lot of books. Like, there is a very famous book on Sunjata called Sunjata, an Epic of Old Mali. That is written by a historian called Diti Nyan. Diti Nyan actually did what this guy is doing. You can see that this guy is a scholar. He's interviewing a griot right there. So the griot were actually professional keepers of information. They were professional historians, if you like. One of their roles was to gather the information in the community and to preserve it orally. So they did not write it down, but they kept it in their minds, and then they passed it down to their children. And so their children, once they grow older, they would also be teaching their younger children. And for this reason, histories were preserved with lots of problems, though. So if somebody wants to write the history of Sunjata, for instance, you would have to interview a number of griots. And once you interview all of these griots, you will then look at the constant factors in the stories, and then you sieve out the factors that are not, you know, that are not consistent in the stories. So if you wanted to write an oral history of Mansa Musa, you would not interview only one griot. You would interview lots of griots so that you can catch some of the inconsistencies, and then the final product could be relied upon to be a good history. And they still exist. And there are griot men and there are griot women. You can see that these are griot women up there. Okay.
Well, I would like to very much thank Dr. Jallo for coming to us today at Metropolitan Community College. We appreciate our good partners in education from Creighton University who've helped us out today. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Barbara. And thank you for coming to listen to this lecture.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Metropolitan Community College on Noon Forum. On today's program, we've heard a talk by Baba Jallo, Assistant Professor of African History and Director of the African Studies Program at Creighton University. He spoke on the topic, The Great Kings and Queens of Africa. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, February 6, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Barbara Velasquez, Coordinator of International and Intercultural Education at Metropolitan Community College, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.